Hi, Eric Stoner. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Stoner co-founded the website Waging Nonviolence. He teaches at St. Joseph's College. He writes a lot and publishes in a who's who of left publications, and he also does nonviolence trainings. So, Eric Stoner, you've written an essay published in a lot of places. It's titled Prepare to Fight a Trump Coup. Its first sentence is, the president might seek to remain in power regardless of what happens in the upcoming elections. Our audience, our OMO variety, our listeners on KABU, they have many times heard fears of the Trump coup that he's signaled so often that he will not step down and use all of his powers as commander-in-chief and also best friend of the police to remain in power. And people in Portland know, and also people around the country, they're organizing to prevent that or defeat it. Let's get right down to it. How do we stop it, stop Trump's coup?
Well, the first thing, you know, I think that we can do, and people seem to be very motivated and energized around right now, is obviously doing everything we can to get people out to vote first, right? And I think the general consensus, you know, is that the larger lead that Biden has, the more that he can possibly win by, the less likely it is that Trump may try to steal the election or kind of remain in power illegitimately. So I think that's the first point. And there are a bunch of different factors and things that people can do in the coming weeks before the election to try to help with that, including signing up to be poll watchers. You know, there's a real shortage of people watching the polls and getting involved in that way, but also potentially even accompanying people who feel in danger or threatened but want to go out and vote in person. So some people are even preparing in that regard. Yeah, just doing everything we can, you know, ahead of time is going to be key. But, you know, I think there is a real concern that, you know, the margin might not be so large and that he will attempt to do everything he can to stay in power. You know, if that happens, then we have to move into phase two and a different kind of resistance. You know, thankfully, I think there is a lot that we can do and a lot that we can learn from other countries that have actually thwarted attempted coups from around the world in recent decades. And there's been some pretty interesting research done on that topic. I think some of the key points, I think, are that often coups have been thwarted. When they have been thwarted, it's happened relatively quickly, you know, often within weeks, if not days, because I think that initial period, right, when a dictator or autocrat is trying to consolidate power, that's when they're most vulnerable. And so I think the key would be to come out quickly and strongly and in large numbers as possible to not give any legitimacy to Trump if he tries to stay on. I think, you know, if there is any equivocation by people in the press, by other politicians, by people on the streets, I think he will try to exploit that. So we have to be really firm and very clear that we will not accept anything less than every vote being counted and a free and fair election.
You mentioned nonviolence. It's necessary to do it nonviolently, and I suppose try and suppress violence, particularly by the right. It doesn't come naturally, though, to be determinedly nonviolent. How do you talk to people in your trainings? We all get angry when we get pushed around or fearful. How do we control those responses?
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned a key point there in terms of training. You know, it doesn't necessarily come naturally to folks, and we all can be kind of triggered and, you know, want to lash out or respond, I think, in violent ways. And so I think it is critical, actually, to have training. And most mass successful nonviolent movements have involved a very serious program of training of activists ahead of major confrontations and protests so that they can be prepared and can understand the importance of kind of nonviolent discipline, at least strategically. You know, a lot of times people don't necessarily believe in nonviolence from a moral or ethical perspective, but I think a lot of people can agree that at least in the moment, there is kind of a strategic necessity to try to refrain from violence. And I think in this case, that's obviously true in that Trump has tried to provoke violence and I think will try to provoke violence among his supporters and to use that, right, to bolster his claim for law and order, which he's been talking about in recent months. And the more there are scenes of violence and real ugly confrontation or street fighting, that's going to kind of move, I think, people who are on the fence and don't know what to do in a very tense moment towards Trump's position. And so I think we have to be very, very careful to try to present as strong and clear of a nonviolent front as possible. And, you know, there are different ways, you know, different factors, right, to consider when about how to do that. You know, I think one thing is that numbers matter. And if enough people come out, it can overwhelm potential violence. So if you think about what happened in Charlottesville, right, the tragic scene that unfolded there back in 2017, but what most people don't remember maybe is that the next week there was another planned march or action by white supremacists in Boston. But in that case, you had 40,000 people that came out to confront a few dozen neo-Nazis, and they were overwhelmed, and it deflated the whole situation, and no violence occurred. So I think getting people out in large numbers can be key. But another thing is, I think if there is real concern, if the threat of violence is higher and more expected, it could mean changing tactics and not necessarily coming out in huge numbers in the street, but being more targeted and not giving the right wing such an easy target for violence.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here with Eric Stoner. He co-founded the website Waging Nonviolence. He teaches and writes about how to defeat authoritarian governments, what has worked around the world. He also does nonviolence training. Eric, we've been talking about dealing with the necessity of having an initial very, very strong response, but it all has to be strategic. I'm wondering about the possibilities. In Portland, of course, we've had a lot of experience of violence, most of it by the police. They're always looking for an excuse to disperse, stop these radicals and drive them out of town. They've done that for years now, actually, since the 1999 Great Action and taking over the central city of Seattle for a while. That scared every police force in the world, the military and the FBI and all the rest of them wondered, how do we protect our city from vast numbers of people? It was completely open in Seattle. It could have burned down. I'm so shocked that it didn't. I was there, actually. Somebody didn't start a fire in Nordstrom's and the Bank of America. All of them were absolutely undefended. Anyway, they're terribly frightened of large crowds, and they'll do anything to break them up. And they're trained to do that. That's the militarization is, in fact, precisely on that point as I read it. Is it possible to both have a really large initial rally and at the same time have, let's say, affinity groups of some kind, trained people who can examine who are in the march looking for those agent provocateurs? I think there are a lot of them in Portland, some of them police, some of them Nazis, some of them just freelance crazies, who do minor violence, but in ways that they know that the police are going to respond. Lots of people here have been seriously injured. Is it possible to have a sufficient force and a sufficient number of sort of trained people to look out for the agent provocateurs, or is that a hopeless task?
I don't think that's a hopeless task, and there is a long history of the use of protest marshals or peacekeepers, they're sometimes called, who are trained to do exactly what you're describing, to kind of to fan out and be you know, particularly on the edges of a protest where, you know, sometimes that's where you'll see people engaging in tactics and violence in ways that are counter to the spirit or the kind of ground rules laid out by the organizers of a march. And then they can engage folks on the fringes saying that this is not consistent and try to get them to stop, or if not, to potentially maybe even distance the more nonviolent movement from the contingent that is engaging in those kinds of tactics, to try to distinguish the two so that they don't conflate that, where there's less risk of conflating their actions with the wider kind of mass nonviolent movement. There's a long history of that with nonviolent protests, and that actually being successful at de-escalating or diffusing potentially violent or violent situations. So I think that is an important thing, and there are actually a lot of trainings happening right now as well around de-escalation and it's called unarmed civilian protection and kind of active bystander intervention. So these are all kind of terms and ways that people are preparing now to do exactly what you're describing. And so I think that is important for people to prepare, because the moments are going, it is going to be a very, I think, intense time that we're facing here, and a very dangerous one. And so we need to use the next few weeks to prepare as much as possible. And I think training is important. You know, one group that has newly formed is called Choose Democracy, and they're available at choosedemocracy.us. And they have a list of trainings that are being put on around the country and online for all these different types of roles that people can play in movements. And then they also are offering their own trainings, including one tonight, but a handful of trainings over the next week that people can sign up for and are free and just online. So I think as much as people can prepare right now, the better. Also, as I was saying earlier, you know, I think if there is a real threat of violence, changing tactics can also be helpful. One approach that George Lakey, a columnist at Waging Nonviolence, has written about on our site recently is that rather than maybe having a large rally outside of the courthouse or a federal building, you know, that maybe if there's a real threat of violence, you know, changing tactics in a way that makes you less vulnerable can be important. So, you know, rather than doing that, perhaps getting in your car and having a car caravan in front of local officials' houses or places of worship, or sending in smaller teams to occupy their offices and demand that they respect the vote and count every vote. Those types of actions can be very powerful and make it less likely that protesters will experience oppression and violence.
Yeah, one final thing. You suggest, and many others, that if it does go a longer haul or a longer period of contestation, mass unrest, shutting down the streets, general strikes, refusals to cooperate with the system, those sometimes can defeat the great powers and gain great public support and build on one another. So ultimately, the regime will be forced to step down. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there is a long history of that happening in other countries around the world when there have been fraudulent elections, or where people have tried to stay on, like we are concerned Trump might do here. And, you know, I think it is important to realize that just having street protests is not probably going to be sufficient in a situation like this, that to really be effective, you often need to use more dramatic tactics that are more disruptive of business as usual. And one that you mentioned that you often see in these situations is the general strike, you know, that you need, as much as possible, if people can refuse to cooperate with the system and go on strike and shut down cities or different aspects of society, that can be the game-changing decision or tactic that is used that eventually leads to a dictator stepping down. And you've kind of seen that all over the world. So I think people need to be prepared to use more dramatic tactics in that regard. But I think continuing to be nonviolent, you know, in the process will be critical.
Eric Stoner, it was really good talking to you. In the future on KBOO, we'll be talking about those issues as well as the issues of influencing the police and public officials, trying to make sure that the police and the army honor their constitutional duties. Those sorts of interventions can make a difference. Today, I've been talking to Eric Stoner of Waging Nonviolence. Thanks so much for talking to us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
All right. So long.